Hello and welcome back to the NovPod, your beginner's guide to obstetric anaesthetics. I'm Owen Dorn, one of your co-hosts, and this podcast is hosted in association with the Royal College of Anaesthetists and in association with the Obstetrics Anaesthetics Association. And today, Rosie and I are joined by Gail, a senior midwife coordinator from a major London teaching hospital. Gail will be able to take us through how they assess babies and mums' well-being on labour wards and how they can predict difficulties. We will even cover some CTGs. And finally, in the second part of the episode, we will go on to try and decipher some of the acronyms on a labour ward board to make them less like hieroglyphics when you first start. As ever, I hope you enjoyed the episode. Welcome back to episode 5 for now on NovPods, your beginner's guide to obstetric anaesthetics. I'm one of your co-hosts, I'm Owen Dorr. I'm an anaesthetic reg in Thames Valley. And with me, as always, is my partner in crime,
Rosie Grimes.
And we're joined today by Gail, who's one of the senior midwifery team and one of the London hospitals around the surrounding area.
That's right.
Hello, Gail.
Hello. You're
also not only a senior midwife, an ex-A&E nurse, and
yes,
you also work in festivals as well.
Yes, I do.
Indeed. Fantastic. So you're multi-threat and multi-knowledge of spheres to pass on to us.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, I think I'm just easily bored. I like to keep going, keep being entertained. Yeah, so I'm a labour ward coordinator at a large hospital, tertiary unit within South London.
So you actually must have worked with an anaesthetist in quite a few different environments, because obviously we're prolific, we're everywhere, we're in recess, we're on the labour ward.
Yeah.
How do you find working with obstetric anaesthetists on labour ward?
I'd like to think I've got a reasonable understanding of what your role is, so that helps a lot, and knowing anaesthetists in different settings made life easier.
Yeah.
I think that it can actually be quite isolating for anaesthetists on a labour ward, because they're coming into an environment that's very different. You know, the women are awake.
Yeah.
A lot of the time your patients are not awake and they're ill. Women are not unwell. They're having babies. Mm. This is a major life event for them. On the whole, they're well people that are having babies. So that's very different as well. It can be quite different for the obstetric anaesthetists to understand our role as midwives, because nurses work under the direction of a doctor, whereas midwives are autonomous practitioners and will make decisions and make plans and do more than you'd be expected to do as a nurse. So I think that's probably a bit of a transition that anaesthetists maybe need to understand and need to get used to. You know, it may be that they find it quite unusual that we're given direction or asking for something that normally would come from a medical colleague.
Yeah, it's a different environment.
Very.
I think a midwife really is a Swiss Army knife, if I'm being honest.
Like that.
Got someone who's able to deliver something in the community, go in, assess people when they're in the clinic, to reassure someone through being in a room with them for 12 hours and be able to do essentially basic surgical skills, right? Mm. And all do that whilst being in a high intensity environment where you can have some people who have very difficult births for them personally, but the midwife's there for 12 hours dealing with someone who's having an issue communicating. And my respect and appreciation of midwives has only actually increased since I've gone on in my years, and I've started to get rid of some of those preconceptions that people have told me. Yeah. And it's not just because, Gail, you're sitting here and I'm looking for feedback on this. And when you've got good coordinating midwife, actually your day goes a lot better.
Yeah.
They can be your best friend, can't they? I think the reputation of the midwife is that they're quite scary. Almost like a matriarch, and, you know, you need to get the coordinator on the side kind of thing. And I'm sure that's true in
some areas.
I often think that the way that midwives behave and what they do can influence a birth so much. It's and you really have to use that power properly.
And that's quite a rewarding thing, as you know, from the fact you've had about 15 different jobs.
Yeah.
Midwifery coordinator, what does that actually involve?
It's kind of like air traffic control on the labour ward. So there's always two of us on. One will be in charge and the other senior midwife kind of troubleshoots and is available to support staff. So it's really managing, I guess, the throughput of women, managing order of things, supporting midwives, working really closely with the obstetric team and the anaesthetic team, and then other teams like obstetric medicine, just keeping the flow going on labour ward, making sure things are safe, making sure information is passed on. Communication is the absolute key on a labour ward, and understanding that things can change quickly, and you just have to be able to adapt to that and make sure that the right people are in the right place to do the right thing for the women.
Nice, I like that. And also the fact that you bring a calm to the chaos of that because of that good communication, that touching base.
Have you got any tips for our obstetric anaesthetic novices to navigate making that jump from absolute stranger to being a bit more of an effective member of the MDT?
So I always do a walk around, but the anaesthetic room is where I start and say hi to the anaesthetists that are on. If it's someone I've not seen before, find their name out. And I always think you could be in a Cat 1 in the next 2 minutes if I at least know their name and they know my name. So I usually say, have you done OBS before? Do you like it?
Yeah.
And if they say no, I'm like, don't worry, we'll look after you. It's cool. You'll be fine. I would say get to know people. Say hi. Don't stay in the anaesthetic room.
Yes. Yeah, agreed.
Come and sit around the desk. Come and go through the board. Definitely just be visible.
And inquisitive.
Exactly. Tell us, you know, where you are. Come and do a board round if you want to. Say, look, I'm just wondering, is that lady going to need theatre? Just check in all the time and just be part of the team. We know it's tricky because you might only be there 3 months.
That's always made my obstetric experience better, actually. If it is isolating, if you're the sole member on, go and make yourself part of the team, introduce yourself to people and get to know people through the hour as well.
Especially at like 2 a.m. when you're just feeling really sorry for yourself.
That's really good. That's a nice introduction into labour wards, but unfortunately, it's not all about midwives and anaesthetists, as much as we would like it to be. There's apparently someone that's even more important than them on labour ward, isn't there?
Obstetricians.
I said more important. It is the patients. What's labour ward for? Because I know there are other wards that people can give birth on that are midwife-led. Why is there two?
Low-risk midwifery-led units look after women who don't need any medical intervention, it's not anticipated, and will see a midwife from the start of pregnancy through to the end of their postnatal care. On a midwife-led unit, you would have, for pain relief, Entonox, morphine or similar, and then, the third stage drugs. Anything more than that, they would be talking to us about.
Okay, so they'd have to move around.
Yeah. Labour ward is where obstetricians will be present the whole time, you know, a whole multidisciplinary team.
So labour wards are areas for people who would be of high risk or are more likely to need intervention or definitely will receive intervention.
Yeah.
And women come from all sorts of directions. So it might be that they are admitted in spontaneous labour through an assessment unit. They might come for an induction of labour. There might be an elective section planned.
When I started labour ward, I was surprised to hear that the stork doesn't just deliver the baby.
No.
Apparently there's a few different stages you have to go through.
There are generally. So generally, labour is defined as being regular painful contractions that dilate the cervix. 4 centimetres onwards is definitely labour. There are caveats. So we will often have a call from the assessment unit saying we've got a lady who's 2 centimetres, her waters have broken, she's really struggling, she'd like an epidural. So this is what makes it so hard. Obstetrics, midwifery, there's no absolute answer to anything. You know, it might be if A and B happen, we'll do C. And if some women go from A to C, so it's there's never absolutes. Second stage is fully dilated, usually an hour for descent, sometimes longer. And then expulsive contractions, I think, is a definition. And that's when the baby's pushed out.
When do you start to get the thought process of like, okay, this isn't progressing as we would want it to?
So on a medical timeline, we say 0.5 centimetre an hour.
Okay.
For a primip, probably 1 centimetre an hour for a multip. Mm-hmm. Again, you know, it varies, there are caveats. If you examine a woman at 9 a.m, she's 4 centimetres. You examine her at 1 o'clock and she's 5, then that would be considered to be a failed to progress or slow progress in labour.
Mm-hmm.
That's the point. If the waters were intact, you would say to her, look, we'd like to offer to break your waters and see in a couple of hours if things have moved along. If the waters have already gone, you'd have a discussion at that point about syntocinon.
Mm-hmm.
If there isn't an epidural and she's someone open to a chat about pain relief, then we would chat that through, because that's often the point when they would like you guys in before the syntocinon goes up.
Syntocin is a oxytocin drug.
Kind of, it's oxytocin, synthetic hormone that we call Synto. It's all referred to as Synto. So we would use that to lengthen and strengthen and increase the frequency of contractions. You titrate it up until you achieve those contractions, whereas you're giving it to contract the uterus. Yeah. In theatre, in those small increments.
Which you definitely wouldn't want to do the high doses with someone in labour. Because No. Second stage, why do I get calls? Why do people say you need to deliver this? Their second stage has been going on for too long. Yeah. Why can't it go on for longer?
So in an ideal world, you're balancing out. You're looking at the monitoring. Does the baby still seem okay? Baby's moving, which is harder for mums to feel often in labour. And the heart rate on the monitoring are the things we've got to tell us. If that's all okay, the other thing you're thinking about is the pelvic floor. So if you've got prolonged second stage, we know that that can cause problems later.
Mm-hmm.
Realistically, women will tend to push for about an hour. If you think birth is reasonably imminent, maybe longer. Or the woman might say, I don't want to stop now. I don't want any interventions. But if the head is still high, the baby's looking sideways, we've not had any sign of birth, then that's the point where we probably say, look, we'd like to do a trial in theatre. This is what we propose. Anaesthetist will come and chat to you about the pain relief you've got, the epidural, and do what we call a top-up, or you haven't got anything, so they'll talk to you about something called a spinal, and they'll talk you through, and then, yeah, that's when you guys are called for that.
The longer it's left and the more the pelvis is pushing down the baby's head, the more swelling goes into the area as well.
Yeah, and the baby will probably have caput, so that soft swelling on the top of their head, which can make it more tricky to put a suction cup on, and then you're looking really at forceps. It's to do with all sorts of things. So if the baby seems fine, it's also to do with the operator. Experience and confidence of the person who's going to deliver the baby may be part of the decision-making that they discuss with the woman. It may be that it's influenced by that. So it does vary.
A bit like we get in anaesthetics for a trauma case for someone who's broken their hip. Some people may say do an injection in their back. Some people may say put that person to sleep, right? Yeah. You're getting the same information and people using their own expertise to make that decision.
What they're comfortable with, yeah.
And then what's the third stage?
So the third stage is once the baby's born, the placenta is delivered. The uterus needs to contract and then that kind of completes birth.
And like we hear people talking about the board around like physiological management of the third stage of labour. What's...
So that would be seen probably more commonly on a midwife-led unit. So that means delivery of the placenta by maternal effort without any drugs involved.
Okay.
At all. Whereas more routinely we would give syntometrin or syntocinon, depending where you work, and then deliver the placenta by controlled cord traction.
Okay.
So we would physically do it as a midwife.
And that's active management,
that's
right?
That's active management, yeah. Yeah.
So fourth stage, if anyone was to talk about that, would be everything's done, right?
Yeah, so I mean, you do sometimes read about the fourth stage of labour, but it's not something that a recognised thing. Really what's happening at that stage is that, you know, the skin to skin's going on.
Yeah.
Suturing, that kind of thing, and making everyone comfortable. Exactly, the tea and toast that's so important when you've had a baby.
Amazing.
Why do I have to move my ECG dot so you can have skin to skin? Why can't we leave the baby in the cot and my beautiful ECG dots can just stay
there?
Yeah,
I'm sorry about that. Yeah, lots and lots written about skin to skin. Regulates breathing, heart rate, keeps the baby's temperature normal, promotes feeding if the woman wants to breastfeed, coats the baby in the nice friendly bacteria of mum and dad.
This is skin to skin with baby and the parents, not skin to skin with the baby and the anaesthetist holding
the baby. Well, it can be, you know. Let the baby hold your finger.
Imagine that above the arms going on. Fantastic, right?
Hold your hand.
We've covered a brief interlude into the fact that a stork doesn't just deliver a baby, that we as a MDT team come together to go through various different stages. And stage five is obviously the self-applause and the cup of tea.
Absolutely, yeah.
There are quite a lot of hurdles between that and the waving them out of the baby unit and giving them a high five, both baby and parents. So what do you do to monitor and assess maternal and fetal well-being on the unit?
So it obviously starts before they get to us. You know, they all have had booking blood, scans during pregnancy. Some women will have needed more intervention, FMU input, OBSMED input. Once they're with us, generally because it's labour ward, they will be monitored on a CTG. So mm-hmm. you're monitoring the fetal heart rate, maternal pulse, and uterine activity, contractions. That's the three things that it will tell us.
That's what I ruin every time I'm doing an epidural by moving the band.
Well, no, that's fine. So you're quite right that the midwife's role while an epidural's going in really is just to monitor the fetal heart and then support the woman who will still be contracting most of the time. You've got to have dialogue between the anaesthetist and the midwife when the epidural's going in.
I'm like, please just tell me if you think something's going wrong because I'm like so task focused.
Yeah, exactly. And so you should be, you know, you're concentrating on what you're doing. So you need us to say, oh, look, we might need to just move or adjust.
So what parts of the CTG are you looking at?
So we're looking at, we look at risk first, define risk. Why is the CTG on? Then we look at contractions, how often they are, how long they last.
You're talking about Dr. Bravado.
Yeah.
Looking at contractions. And that's normally about 3 every 10 minutes.
Yeah, 4. You kind of expect about 4. Most women will contract 4 in 10, lasting around a minute each with a good rest period, soft tummy in between, and that will dilate the cervix for most.
And you can get hyperstimulated if the oxytocin's put on too much, right?
You can. It can happen on its own. It can happen with the induction drugs, pessary gel.
To use tabutiline and things like that sometimes.
Yeah, so tabutiline, salbutamol is used to slow the contractions and it works really well, it works really quickly, but you have to then expect a tachycardia.
Yeah.
From the salbutamol for the mum and the baby, and also if a baby's been exposed to prolonged contraction or had a D-cell, you'll often get a rebound tachycardia anyway.
Okay.
So then you're watching the trace to see what the cause of that might be.
They sound very naughty.
Yeah, they get up to all sorts in there. I quite like them. I quite like the fact that they're in charge and we're not really, and we try and fit everyone into a nice medical box and really the baby decides. Then we are looking at things like the baseline rates. What's the average heart rate for the baby? Is it between 110 and 160 that you'd expect? You're looking at variability, so beat to beat. It's usually between 5 and 25. If you lose variability, then that baby's telling you that they're not happy.
Okay.
You know, that's when you're thinking is a hypoxia. Accelerations where you get a lift above the baseline rate for 15 seconds, 15 beats. In labour, you often don't see accelerations, and we still don't know whether that's of any significance or not.
Okay.
So we don't worry if we don't see them. And then deceleration. So is it just a short, sharp dip that's due to cord compression, or is it a chemical reaction? Are they decelerations that cause us concern?
And over the years, and I could be totally out of date on this now, but I've heard loads of names like typical, atypical, early, late.
Yeah.
Like, what ones do you worry about?
Different hospitals will use different guidelines. Mm. So where I work, we use physiological. So the barrows, the short, sharp ones that are like upside-down triangles, that will, fetal heart rate then comes back to the baseline. You've got lots of nice variability, variation. Unless they go on for a prolonged period, are unlikely to be a problem. So things like change of position will often correct that. It would just mean that the baby isn't pressing on the cord so much when there's a contraction.
Yeah.
The ones that we'd be more concerned about where you've got, they're more U-shaped often, there's not the variability sitting within the D-cell.
Mm-hmm.
You're looking at other factors as well, might tell you why that's happening. You know, the mum might be, we always say septic in labour, but that's such a bad term because it's not sepsis like you and I think of it. You know, pyrexia in labour, there might be all sorts of reasons that tell us why that's likely to be happening, you know, bleeding or things like that. So they're the ones that we're much more concerned about, or prolonged. So more than 3 minutes, the standard thing is to pull the emergency bell.
Yeah.
Conservative measures. If, you know, you're not seeing an improvement in the next 3 minutes, you're thinking, are we going to need to move? The next 3 minutes we're probably in the theatre and then delivering the baby. So there's the rule of threes that we use as well. The 3 minute D-cell, if it's got variability in it and maybe there's just been an epidural sited, or maybe something has happened that makes you think, oh, that's probably why it's happened.
Mm.
We're going to see this improve. If it's not, in the next 3 minutes you're starting to, that's when I'm going out the room saying, I'll just check there's a theatre clear, or I'll just stop that elective section from starting.
Yeah.
And then the next 3 minutes, you know, we're moving ourselves to theatre. We often go in and then we come out again. And that can be quite confusing, I think, for the woman, the birth partner, for everyone to think, well, it was really urgent just now and now it's okay.
Why does it matter? Why can't we? Because we see bradycardic patients all the time and say, oh, we'll check in 15 minutes. Why for kids does it matter so much that we act quickly on decelerations?
I mean, I guess the key thing is that we don't really know what's going on inside there.
Mm.
We don't know what's caused it. Sometimes the only way to deal with it is to deliver the baby. Because otherwise you're working blindly. You know, if there are not any conservative measures that you can try or haven't worked, the key thing is that you're delivering a healthy baby, keeping mum healthy, and not waiting so that when the baby's born there's any compromise. You want to intervene at the right moment.
And then someone mentions normal, suspicious and pathological when they're dealing with them. They're trying to move to cat 1, 2 or 3 really instead. But what do normal, suspicious and pathological mean to you when you're assessing CTGs as an overall assessment?
That terminology, with the physiological, we don't use those terms. However, we know what they mean and we used to use them, so other hospitals will do. Normal, all the features are reassuring. There's nothing that deviates from the norm. Suspicious might be that you have some decelerations there, or you've got loss of variability for not very long. Pathological, you absolutely have a barn door trace that's not normal.
Mm-hmm.
So again, it's always very difficult to define because it depends on the context, the woman, the baby. You know, what's okay for a baby of 41 weeks might not be great for a baby of 42 weeks where there's meconium and a maternal temperature. You know, key thing, especially physiological, is that you are interpreting within context. Is this a small baby you're dealing with who's not going to cope so well with labour?
And one of the other things we were talking about earlier in the context of the earlier episodes about obesity and difficulties with monitoring was fetal scalp electrodes. Do you use those?
Yeah, we do, yeah. It's difficult to monitor abdominally. You can put a tiny clip on the scalp. You need the cervix to be dilated enough to do that, probably 3 centimetres onwards if you're skilled at it. And that will give you a direct heart rate of the fetus. There's no way that you're picking up maternal then.
Mm-hmm.
You hopefully will get a consistent signal. Often really helpful if you can't measure abdominally to try that. Yeah, and we do.
It reminds me of a joke I was saying, Rosie, earlier, of what's the definition of a double-blind trial? It's two orthopaedic surgeons looking at an ECG. What's the obstetric definition of a double-blind trial? It's two anaesthetists looking at a CTG. Really important to highlight that joke is that actually shouldn't be the case, and part of you looking after the mum is understanding a little bit why the midwifery and the obstetric team are wheeling that patient into theatre, and it can lead to interventions as well, right? So one of the interventions we can do is intrauterine resuscitation, IUR. What's that mean and what can we do?
I suppose what we mean, things like changing position, giving fluid if the woman's got a pyrexia, lactate's high, she's dehydrated, urine output's not good, that kind of thing. Or taking away the stress, so stopping the syntocin on to give the baby chance to rest from the contractions for a while. I always think of it as, is there anything to add in or is there anything to take out? Do I need to add in fluids, medication, position change? Do I need to take away the syntocin on? Do I need to take away contractions? That's how I always think of it and just run through in my head. To be honest, we don't tend to use the term resuscitation very often because it's quite a big word and people get a bit scared and think that something drastic is going on. Essentially, what we're trying to do is improve the environment in the uterus to optimise the health of the baby, really. That's what it's about.
And that's what we can help out with well, right? We can help with the application of oxygen, with fluids. We can make sure that it's either in left lateral tilt.
Yeah.
I think labour ward is probably one of the places where I've heard the scariest words and things said so nicely.
Yes.
It was just a bit of bleeding.
All very calm, nothing to worry
so
about.
So calm. Yeah. I think like you're really good at just saying things that are actually quite scary, but very well.
Is a danger there. So I've had this conversation with a few anaesthetists. I can't remember the term they use, but it's the same as you guys do, where unless it's absolute dire emergency, you wouldn't know.
Yeah.
And that for people who are more junior, sometimes it's almost can feel like you're dismissing their concerns because you're like, it's cool, we can sort this out because you're so used to it.
Yeah.
And they are panic stricken, thinking that they don't understand. No, we do. It's fine.
Yeah.
All is well. Do not worry. Is there anyone or anything else you need at this stage?
That's a nice one. I'm gonna
That's how I say it in an attempt not to provoke anxiety among the staff or the woman.
That's very good. Very diplomatic.
Yeah.
The other thing that we wanted to just touch on in terms of maternal well-being assessment was MUSE. Going to like all the other areas of the hospital, you've pews, how do you use MUSE in like day-to-day assessments?
How do you use MUSE? That is fantastic. How do you what amuses you about using MUSE?
Well,
we should specify that we're talking about maternity early warning scores.
Yeah. I do have one concern about it, and that is in any context, be that maternity, peds, whatever, at some point, the patient's OBS will pass through the normal range.
Yeah.
Often as they deteriorate. And there is that kind of concern that if a person who isn't that experienced sees it at that stage, they'll say, don't worry, it's normal. But we now have all the additional things, don't we, on the MUSE and PUS chart. Does the patient look well? Is there concern from the family? Those things as well. So on our computer system, we have the hourly fresh eyes and place for observations, and it calculates the MUSE score for us. It tells the midwife when to escalate, but that doesn't take away clinical judgment, of course. I like how comprehensive it is, and I like that it's there as a prompt if you're not particularly experienced.
Has anyone named their baby after you, Gail?
No.
No?
Not so far after me, no.
Is this why you moved from ED and the paediatric
I was hoping, yeah. I was hoping.
It's too late. By the time they've already got a name, I can't change their name. I can't really change it, no.
I can't scribble it out.
Whereas now you can. But now they're all electronics, it's really hard to scribble it out.
No, I'm hoping one day, but, you know. Maybe on my last ever shift before I retire, I'll ask someone if they'll do it for me.
Love that.
Yeah.
Statistically, do you think you've put people off? With the amount of birth you must have been present at.
Yeah, they probably thought, oh, no. She's tiny, but you know when she's here, don't you? Yeah.
Right, so on to our third part of this wonderful discussion.
Mm-hmm.
Before us, as is really good for podcasts, I've actually written out some things that you can't see, but we will talk through them, because what we're trying to do is demystify or maybe have the Rosetta Stone to the midwifery board to help you decipher and translate some of the things that get written on there. And we've got seven different runes with seven different things written.
Yes.
What would be great is what they mean and what they could mean, if that makes sense, what you're thinking when you say it. So, Rosie, what's up first for Gail to decipher for us?
In room one, a 40-year-old female, and then written next to it is IOLPROM. Then there are some times with some centimetres, and then it says in Owen's very excellent handwriting, oxytocin, I think. Is that an H on the end there?
I'm writing with a drunk 5-year-old in private.
Medical handwriting. Yeah. There you go. Classic. Yeah. So, 40-year-old, so that's age. IOL, induction of labour. We are inducing the labour in some way. Commonly, that would be with prostaglandin, so Propes, Pessary, or Prostin gel. That's given PV. PROM, prolonged rupture of membrane, so the waters have gone more than 24 hours. They would be offered antibiotics for that. Practice might vary, but generally, women whose waters break will be assessed and then would be offered induction after 24 hours.
Why?
Because of the small increase in risk of infection. It's not huge, but if it's your baby, you probably don't want that. Some do decline. And then we've got times, 12 and 4. So generally, we would examine vaginally every 4 hours. And for a first baby, you'd be looking for a half a centimetre an hour of progress, which is what we can see here.
Yeah.
Oxytocin's being given because although the dilation's increased, the contractions have probably slowed to 2 in 10 from 4 in 10, so we keep the momentum going.
What otherwise used to confuse me was the number of Ps. So P, P, PROM, P, 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 PROM.
Yeah. PROM, prolonged rupture of membranes. P, PROM, be a preterm. Prolonged rupture of membranes.
Okay.
And that can be different. You know, you might see that the waters went 2-3 weeks ago. It might not be recent. And if everything's been okay, they have offered the woman to go to as near to term as she can. So again, there's lots of variations.
So similar abbreviation, but potentially very different. significance yes. and management.
When you go back to the from induction, the term that you may well see there would be augmentation, as in to augment, to add to. If she's contracting already, we're giving the syntocin to add to the contraction she's got.
Okay, so room one's got someone who's being inducted for their labour. They have had a prolonged rupture of membranes, which may increase the risk of sepsis. Their cervix is dilated 2 centimetres in 4 hours, which if they're a primate would be about 0.5 centimetre per hour, which would be okay, yeah. and they're on oxytocin. Good, okay, that makes more sense. So we're on to board number two then. So it's a 30-year-old with DCDA. Mm-hmm. It could be something to do with some comics. Then we've got SGA and then 4. Mm-hmm. Supraglottic airway for ARM, or is that ARM? And then induction of labour. So could you decipher that one for me, Gail?
Because different things do mean different things in different contexts, don't they? So 30-year-old, DCDAs, dichorionic, diamniotic twins.
Mm.
Non-identical twins. 2 placentas, 2 sacs, 2 babies. SGA, so small for gestational age, may also be called IUGR. Okay. Intrauterine growth restriction. You might see it written in various different ways. 4 is just a lazy way of writing FOR. And we do it all the time. That's exactly what we would write. And then ARM is ARM, so artificial rupture of membranes. So we are going to pop those membranes with an amni-hook rather than them going spontaneously.
Why would you do that?
So we would induce labour in twins before term because for these babies, they're small. They've got to the point where growing on the inside is probably not going to be as effective as growing on the outside. Simplistically, we'd also be looking at Dopplers, you know, the blood flow to the babies, that sort of thing. We also induce twins before term because there is a slightly increased risk of stillbirth, so okay. intrauterine death, and even more so if they're MCDAs, identical twins.
And is that why we make distinction?
Yeah, so MCDAs are more risky. The risk of twin-to-twin transfusion.
Oh, that's another one that I've seen, TTE.
Yeah, yeah.
S?
Twin-to-twin transfusion, yeah. Other things like growth discordance we're looking at, you know. So there's all sorts of reasons why we'd be keen to offer induction earlier than term for twins. Rupture in the membranes is a way of stimulating labour. What you hope is, by doing that, you will start some contractions. It may or may not work. Once the membranes have been ruptured, talk about an epidural if mum wants one, and then the syntocin on from then on. ARM is another part of the induction of labour
mm-hmm.
cascade.
Thanks, God, because what I thought you were going to say is that we've got someone who likes the DC comics who's coming in for a supraglottic airway for an orthopaedic person to do something with their arm. The thing that I'd like to ask, though, is that often midwives stop me going for a coffee when they're about to do an ARM.
Mm.
Why? Like, do they just hate me being happy?
They do. They do indeed. They want to make your life miserable. If it's an ARM where there's polyhydramnio, so excessive fluid maybe, or there's an increased risk of cord prolapse, what we want to make sure is we've got an anaesthetist and a theatre free in case we had to do a Cat 1 section.
Okay.
It's not common at all, but part of managing labour ward is risk assessment and minimising risk.
So fluid could go, cord could fall out.
Cord could come first.
Prolapse, yeah. bradycardia, off to theatre,
yeah.
coffee, get out the queue.
Exactly, yeah. And cord prolapse, obstetric emergency.
The twins, why are they VIPs on the ward?
Because there's two of them. If you're carrying twins, you're more prone to everything. So you're more likely to get preeclampsia. You're more likely to have all the other complications of pregnancy, like diabetes. You're more likely to be less well grown if there's two of you in there. You have an increased risk of bleeding when you give birth. Everything increases. The risks increase. So the more you're able to mitigate risk, the better,
okay.
I think is probably the best way to put it.
And also, the very important thing about twins is you need to make sure there's 2 tiny hats.
Yes. Aww. 2 tiny hats, 2 neonatologists, despite the fact that often one turns up and we say, you bringing a friend? Oh, do you think I should? I would.
Yeah.
I would, yeah.
2 things not to forget are don't ever give the oxytocin or the carbetocin until the second
Absolutely.
Twin is given.
Absolutely, yeah.
And 2 is to repeat the point that you're going to need double the equipment.
Absolutely. Mm.
Cool, right. Room two, we've got some lovely twins. Who's in room three?
Room three, we've got a 25-year-old lady. There's 36/40. GBS, FTP, and then various times with the centimetre dilation, which are basically almost all the same. And then VE underlined with some aggressive underlining.
That's interesting. What's that mean?
25-year-old woman, birthing person, 36 weeks pregnant. So we always write it out of 40 because it's considered that 40 completed weeks of pregnancy is term. So that's your due date.
Mm-hmm.
GBS is group B strep. We don't routinely test for it in this country. You could test one day and it's present, test another day and it's not. But if you know that a mum's had group B strep identified, often on a urine, sometimes a vaginal swab, then you would offer antibiotic cover to try and reduce the risk of baby being unwell. FTP is written there as failure to progress. It might be called slow progress in labour. Language used is always contentious. That means that the cervix hasn't dilated at the rate that you would expect following a medical timeline. So half a centimetre an hour. This woman was 3 centimetres at 8 a.m., 4 at 12 midday, which is fine, so she's now in labour. But when we reassessed her again at 4 p.m., she was still 4 centimetres.
Mm.
And we have written on the side VE, so vaginal examination.
And why do you examine them in 4 hours?
Yeah, tricky one. So really, you just have to have some guideline. So we follow the 4 hour. I mean, some women will have an examination after 6 hours. Some women will go on to syntocinon and the obstetrician will say, let's examine 4 hours after regular contraction. So it's not set in stone. If, say, there's a prolonged decel in a room, you might find an examination that's happened an hour after this one. Generally, if there's no deviation from the norm, it would be a 4-hourly examination that's offered. And I say offered because some women will decline.
Yeah.
To have it, and you know, it's fine. It's a conversation that we have, but generally 4-hourly.
And why can't we just leave that baby in there?
Eventually, that baby will protest. Eventually, mum will probably develop a pyrexia,
you know,
an inflammatory response. Eventually, the fetal heart will alter.
So this is a proactive step that is taken because multiple years of experience have said if you wait, that leads to worse outcomes for mother and baby.
Yeah, I mean, the aim is always a healthy mum, healthy baby. It's a really tricky one, though, because what you're aiming to do is, again, mitigate risk. And with the best evidence that you have, if you're going to have a medical labour and follow a timeline, that's what we use. I'm definitely not saying it's the perfect way to do it. It's just that we have to have some way to measure, some benchmark, something to measure against to say, this seems to be okay. This is likely deviating from the norm and we might run into trouble.
Yeah, and I guess it's about what you were saying earlier about you're not necessarily just taking one thing in isolation.
No, you're not.
You're looking at the whole picture and thinking, okay, what's physiologically going on here? Where should we go?
Do we need to intervene at this point or shall we wait and see?
Mm-hmm. So Rosie's gone on break and now I've been told there's a lady in room 4, classic Rosie, 44 years young, Schrom, VBAC, FD, for cat two. So I imagine that doesn't mean that we get her two Siamese cats into the room.
We can try.
Right. Yeah.
I mean, we will try and accommodate any requests that we can. So this lady's 44. She, it says, had a previous section for breech. She shrommed. She was planning a vaginal delivery. However, once she started labouring, she changed her mind, which is not uncommon. And she would have been a cat three, but there's some evidence of fetal distress, recurrent deceleration, so she's now lined up for a cat two section. So no immediate threat to mum or baby, but needs delivery.
Okay, and so that's quite a lot of information from birth story you can actually get just by looking at it.
Yep.
So Schrom, like PROM, is to do with the rupture of membranes, but this is spontaneous, it's less than 24 hours.
Yep.
VBAC is vaginal birth after cesarean section.
Yep.
And FD's fetal distress. So we know that, and with the cat too, we know that this baby will be coming out usually within an hour.
Yeah.
With VBAC, what do we worry about? So what do you worry about with a vaginal birth after cesarean section?
What we're really looking out for is evidence of scar rupture,
mm-hmm.
dehiscence. What you're interested in as well is why was the previous cesarean section done? So this woman had a breech baby, elected to have a section, so she's never laboured.
Okay.
She might labour beautifully, but she's labouring like a primate. You know, this is the first time she's laboured. So we always bear in mind, why was the section done? Evidence of scar rupture would be abnormalities in the fetal heart rate, mm-hmm. vaginal bleeding, pain over the scar. If she's contracting, it might suddenly change, suddenly stop. Pain that's coming through, even if she's got pain relief. And women are counselled antenatally in terms of the level of risk. You know, percentages, stats are given to them if they want to know, that kind of thing.
And the FD could also be a forceps delivery. Yeah,
yeah, or FX, written for forceps as well.
Okay. Numero five.
I've got now gone for break and there's now Rosie. We're pretty tag team in this one-person wardrobe.
Oh, is there an anaesthetist on label ward or not?
Not a good one.
Stuffing around. So this one's a 34-year-old lady. She is 30 weeks and it says PET, BMI 50.
I mean, we're immediately concerned.
We're concerned.
We are, yeah. So she's preterm. She has preeclampsia. To what degree does she have it? Are we worried about HELLP syndrome? Is this preeclampsia that we've been monitoring for a few weeks? She's been an inpatient. Is the baby well grown? What symptoms are we worried about? Is she very hypertensive? You know, all those sorts of things go through your mind just from seeing those three letters, PET. Yeah. Then we add on the BMI. The thing I think about mostly for that is you guys, you know, have you guys seen her? Does your consultant know we might be delivering this woman in the middle of the night? Hopefully not. Concern really for you guys, then the obstetricians who are going to do the surgery if we need to deliver, then theatres in terms of any additional equipment we might need.
Yeah.
But yeah, this one's absolutely for you guys.
I think the other thing with the BMI is that I didn't necessarily always fully appreciate that sometimes that's a booking BMI. And the situation now is even more.
Yeah.
Than before. There are differences depending on when you've done it and, you know, how much of that is baby and water and things like that.
It's a serious risk.
Yeah.
And it's something, you know, a woman like this needs a planned delivery, ideally. You really don't want to be delivering her at 4 a.m. if you can help it.
Do you ever put abbreviations for the neonatal doctors being aware, or would they want to know about a...
As soon as someone comes through the door who's preterm, we tell them. Look through the notes, see if you've got an estimated fetal weight. Let them know whether steroids have already been given or whether they're planned. Do you want to deliver? Will you be giving magnesium? And then we write on the board, NICU aware.
Okay, so we're on to bed six.
Mm-hmm.
Let's go. Me and Rosie are both here now. We're both caffeinated.
Oh,
and
fantastic.
After our six-person wardrobe, I'm feeling very tired. It says 20 female,
mm-hmm.
as in a 20-year-old female, not 20 females in a room.
Short of beds.
It says... BBA, mm-hmm. SVD, MEC, MROP, SCABU. So that's BBA, SVD, MEC, MROP, SCABU. I've written it and I'm finding it hard to say. What does any of that mean?
Quite a lot going on there, isn't there? So 20-year-old, not an absolute, but actually young women often do deliver quickly and well. BBA, born before arrival, is a kind of standard abbreviation that we would use, meaning the baby was born outside of a medical facility.
Okay.
So it might be home, might be in an ambulance, might be in a taxi, might be in the lift on the way up to labour ward. So just born outside of the maternity unit, that's what that means. SVD is spontaneous vaginal delivery. Sometimes you'll see NVD, normal vaginal delivery.
Mm-hmm.
Sometimes you might see the word born, because babies are born and parcels are delivered, really, aren't they? So you might actually see baby's been born. I sometimes write that too.
Yeah.
MEC is meconium. We don't use thin or thick anymore. It's MEC is MEC. MROP, manual removal of placenta. That would have been a woman who went into theatre because the placenta hadn't delivered. And then SCABU, special care baby unit. So the baby's had to go for some monitoring.
Okay, so it's quite a story there. The baby's come out, not in the medical facility.
Yeah.
It's past meconium poo as it's come out. And so it could have aspirated, which might be on SCABU. And she's awaiting for a manual removal of placenta. So she might have had some postpartum hemorrhage. There's an important area to clarify because there's a lot of very sensitive things that go on and very sad journeys that people go through. And there are some abbreviations that are written on the board that are really critical to understand.
Yep.
Are there any of those that you think a novice anaesthetist should understand?
Labour wards will also have an area for bereavement because those women give birth. We look after them from 18 weeks upwards. So you might see IUD, as in intrauterine death. You might see SB for stillbirth. And you might see that actually, you know, in another woman's history, previous SB, NND, neonatal death. So there are things you might see in a woman who's actually labouring and going to have a live baby. You might see MTOP, medical termination of pregnancy. So the baby's deceased, but the parents have had to make the really difficult decision to end the pregnancy because there's abnormalities. All of those things really are talking about a baby that won't be born alive. The anaesthetist will often be involved for talking through pain relief.
Yes.
Yeah. Also, in a kind of HDU sense, because those women are more at risk of things like sometimes infection, DIC, things like that. So you may well be involved because of that sensitive area, and we do appreciate that. Might be the first time that you guys have had to talk with a woman who's going to have a pregnancy loss. So tell us if it's too hard. Tell us if you need us to go with you. Yeah.
I think a really good piece of advice is to take an experienced midwife, and usually there's an experienced midwife in the room with them, and before them, pre-brief, what has the emotional state been in the room, what language they like to be used, what's the medical history going on. As you said, if you're getting someone who's septic that may have a little bit of DIC, you don't want to be offering someone a epidural and get their expectations up to that when you can't deliver it. So do lay some groundwork before you go there. And then it's about having the sensitive conversations in the appropriate manner. Okay, thank you for that. And I mean, there's some very basic ones about G and P that we've touched on in other episodes.
G is number of pregnancies and P is number of babies. But that, even with that, there's discussion. Every aspect of obstetrics and midwifery, there's an if and a but. Nothing's an absolute. Usually, if you see gravity 2, para 1, that means this woman's been pregnant twice and she's given birth once.
Yeah.
The pluses will refer to things like ectopic pregnancy, miscarriage.
And then we've got just a little footnote on position, because it says OT, OP. Does that mean outpatient physio?
Absolutely. So breech is not the head presenting, but it could be the feet or the bum. The O refers to the occiput, so you're always kind of using that as your landmark. OT means that the occiput's in the transverse position. So the baby's looking sideways.
Mm-hmm.
OP, occiput downwards, baby's looking upwards. OA, occiput is anterior, baby's looking down towards the floor. That's your optimum position to come out.
Okay. We want to be OA.
Want to be OA, yeah.
And if they're ideally not, you can't refer them to OP, outpatient physio.
You can't.
No. Okay. That's fantastic. That's been quite a journey, Gail.
Thank you.
Yeah, thanks for coming. Pleasure. We've gone through what the labour ward does and what the maternal journey is. We've gone through how we look after maternal and fetal well-being throughout their stay on labour wards. And then we've talked through amazingly handwritten labour ward boards.
Absolutely. Fantastic.
And before you leave us, just to go back to top tips that you would say to our novice anaesthetists listening to really excel on that labour ward.
Let's say hi immediately, get to know each other, be part of the team, come and sit and chat to us. If you are not sure about something, come and ask the coordinators, because we will help you out. Don't be afraid to say that you need help or to share your knowledge as well, because you teach us a lot. So, you know, just come and be part of the team. Even if it's 3 months there, it doesn't matter. Just come and join in and we'll look after you.
And on that wonderful note, thank you once again.
Pleasure.
Hello and welcome to the outro. Big thanks to Gail for being such a fantastic guest and taking me and Rosie through the board so well. The premise for this episode came from a labour ward handover where I hadn't really understood at the very beginning of my obstetric anaesthetics journey what all these acronyms meant. It resulted in a terrible handover, and I hope I've spared you the embarrassment of that for yourself. One of the questions that was asked to us by a peer reviewer is, why have we said not to give uterotonics before the baby is out? To clarify, there's two broad categories that we're talking about uterotonics here. One is much lower doses that are used by the obstetric and gynae team when they're thinking about the induction or augmentation of labour. And then there are much higher doses that we as the anaesthetic team can give. The much higher doses are for the third stage to massively increase uterine tone to prevent uterine atony and therefore the risk of postpartum hemorrhage. If you were to give those at such higher doses before the baby was out, it would be very difficult to deliver the baby.
So the reason that we can't wait for women who are failing to progress or have a prolonged second stage to wait until the morning is that it could be a sign of obstructed labour, which carries risks to the maternal and fetal well-being, including pelvic floor damage, risk of a PPH, and also fetal distress.
Moving on, there are some feedback forms for the NovPod on the RCOA website that we'd invite you to fill in. And please, as always, do share with your friends, your colleagues, or with your department if you think this has been a useful resource, as it helps spread the learning. Next episode coming up, we have obstetric emergencies with an obstetrician. In this episode, we will cover everything from what obstetricians would like from us in an emergency to what specific obstetric emergencies, such as core prolapse, maybe we'd be dealing with on the labour ward. It's a fascinating episode. I look forward to seeing you there. For now, all the best.